glad to be back with you. On my mind this week, watching with grave concern the fires in California, and with astonishment, the revelations about Harvey Weinstein that were apparently an open secret for years, but only now become public. Last week, two-term Tennessee Republican Senator Bob Corker, who heads the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, tweeted, among other things, that President Trump could lead us into World War III. The question is, will other Republicans speak up, and will they take action?
What Bob Corker said is frankly what a lot of other Republicans think, but they're afraid to say it.
That's James Homan, national political correspondent for The Washington Post, author of The Daily 202. He joined me from his office at The Washington Post then.
Once there was a funny animal. He had a party. All the animals came. They did not like it, so they left. The end.
A conversation with author-illustrator Sandra Boynton. First, James Homan, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. James Homan, how great to talk with you again.
Good to be with you.
You wrote earlier this week about the escalating feud between President Trump and Bob Corker. Talk about that. I mean, where is it going and what does it mean?
Well, what it means is that the president, I think, is being pretty short-sighted, that he isn't trying to play the long game. He's not serious about actually trying to pass legislation. The president has this instinct to be a counterpuncher where all he knows how to do, he knows one speed, which is just full speed ahead. And when someone punches him, he punches back much harder. I think it speaks to a lot of concern that Republicans have privately, that Corker was just willing to verbalize, that maybe Trump is not just in over his head, but really needs to be managed by people around him, serious adults in the room.
But that is the question, isn't it? How far will Bob Corker's words carry? Will other Republicans move to speak out as well, or are they all huddled together waiting to see what's going to happen?
They are all huddled together waiting to see what's going to happen. It's been kind of surprising. I'll tell you, based on my own reporting on Capitol Hill, that what Bob Corker said is frankly what a lot of other Republicans think, but they're afraid to say it. They're afraid of backlash in the 2018 midterm elections. They're afraid of Steve Bannon running a primary challenger against them. And so they're worried about crossing Trump because he's unpredictable. It actually has been kind of interesting. Even some of Corker's good friends in the Senate didn't come publicly to his defense. And the Senate is in recess this week because it was Columbus Day. And so a lot of senators have avoided commenting on the whole back and forth.
James, what I'm worried about is Corker's comments about a possible third world war. I think everybody is on edge about that.
And that's absolutely something to be on edge about. You know, this isn't just any Republican. This is the Republican chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. This is someone who was a finalist to be President Trump's Secretary of State, who he considered for the job of vice president. This isn't, you know, someone who was a never Trumper by any stretch. And in fact, since Senator Corker made his comments on Sunday that Trump's policies and behavior are moving us toward World War III, we saw the Japanese defense minister say that he thinks there's a good chance that President Trump is going to use military action against North Korea as early as next month. And the escalation continues up on the Korean Peninsula. The U.S. continues to run aggressive military drills. And there are a lot of reasons to be very worried. You know, the week before last, when Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was trying to negotiate with the North Koreans, President Trump tweeted that he was wasting his time, that there's only one solution, implying that that solution is a military solution. We heard from the White House that on Tuesday of this week, President Trump got a sit-down briefing about military options in North Korea from Joseph Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and James Mattis, the defense secretary. So there are definitely, Diana, a lot of signs that we are marching toward war. And we saw an interesting column this past weekend from Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times, who just spent a week in Pyongyang in North Korea. And he reports that over there, all the North Koreans he talked to think that a nuclear war with the United States would be winnable, and that they think it's only a matter of time before such a conflict happens. So you have all the ingredients, you know, two hot-headed leaders who continue to practice brinksmanship, military people who are preparing for war. There's a lot of reasons to be very worried that World War III is close at hand.
James, when the Pentagon folks come over and talk with President Trump, are they saying to him, this is not a good idea, not only for the U.S. and North Korea, but for the world?
Yes. So the military folks have been trying to restrain the president. And that is one of the things that started the whole, you know, President Trump's attacks. What we believe happened is that President Trump was watching Fox News Sunday, the Sunday program, and Chris Wallace played a clip of Senator Corker from last week saying that he is very grateful that John Kelly is the White House Chief of Staff and Mattis is the Defense Secretary and Tillerson is at the State Department, because those three gentlemen are the only thing holding the country back from chaos and war. And so that, seeing that clip on TV on Sunday, is what set the president off. And that, you know, that actually speaks to a real truth that we know from sources inside the White House, which is that those three guys kind of make up a triumvirate that are restraining the president, that are trying to keep him from going to war. One of the things I think a lot of people don't understand is usually not always, but the military folks are the ones who bear the brunt of the conflict. They're the ones who have seen comrades die in war in Iraq or Vietnam or whatever it was. And so they don't want to, you know, fight a land war in Asia, because they understand that the hard truth is you can't win a land war in Asia. It's not winnable. You're just, the casualties are going to be too great, especially if it's a nuclear confrontation. They know tens of thousands of Americans would die, and these are men under their command. And so I think they're much more worried about using the military and using force generally than President Trump, who got several deferments and avoided service in Vietnam.
Then the question becomes, can the president act and force, for example, the dropping of the nuclear weapon without the agreement, the total agreement of the three men you named, plus the military?
Yeah, Diane, I think this could get us into serious danger. I think military guys are accustomed and indoctrinated to follow orders. And if the president gives an order, are they going to not follow that order? It's sort of hard to imagine that they would not follow a direct order given by the president. But it's also, you know, rumored that there's some kind of agreement between these three gentlemen that I mentioned, that if one of them gets fired by Trump, the other two will resign in protest, and that will sort of keep the three of them together. I'm not sure that that's true. It's sort of widely talked about in foreign policy circles, but it speaks to the fact that these guys may find themselves put in a really precarious position where they either have to do something that would result in lots of death or disregard an order that they feel would be dangerous and immoral.
So we're back to the Congress. What power can or might Republicans wield in the face of that kind of potential destruction?
So this is the million-dollar question. I think there are some Republicans who are real hawks, and they kind of are a little bellicose and swashbuckling. And then you have other people who I think are nervous about the use of force. And the question now is, what is Bob Corker going to do about his concerns? If he genuinely believes, and I think he does genuinely believe, that Trump is taking us on a path toward World War III, if on the current trajectory, he has the ability to do something about it. He can pass legislation that would tie the president's hands. He could hold hearings. He could could do various things, hold up Trump nominees. There's a precedent here. William Fulbright in the 1960s, he was a Democratic senator from Arkansas, and he held hearings on Vietnam when Lyndon Johnson, another Democrat, was president. So a Democratic senator who was chairing the Foreign Relations Committee sort of was concerned that Lyndon Johnson wasn't making good foreign policy and reined him in. They tied his hands. They passed several amendments that kind of curtailed the war in Vietnam. If Corker wanted to do that, Democrats would certainly go along with it, and a couple of Republicans would too. And so this is when the rubber hits the road. His legacy isn't going to be defined by his quotes to reporters. It's going to be defined by whether he actually does something about it.
James, I understand at least the plan was announced that there was going to be a lunch between President Trump and Secretary of State on Tuesday. Did that happen, and do we know what transpired?
We know it happened for sure, and we know, you know, the official word from the White House spokespeople was that it was a good lunch, and the president expressed confidence in Tillerson to stay on as Secretary of State. We you know, there were only three people in the lunch, so it's hard to get people to leak about what really happened. So we don't know what actually transpired, but we know that they did meet, and the White House said it went really well.
So, in the face of all this foreign policy concern regarding North Korea, Japan, and others, what happens to the Republican agenda? Is there anywhere to go, for example, on a tax plan?
Well, Republicans want to get tax cuts done very badly. And one of the reasons I think that they've avoided criticizing Trump after he went after Senator Corker is because a lot of Republicans who are privately very scared of Trump and think he's really dangerous care more about getting tax cuts through than they care about trying to tie Trump's hands. And so they're biting their lip because they really want to get this tax cut deal done. In the Senate, Republicans only have two votes to spare just to do basic tax cut. To do tax real reform, to overhaul the tax code, you need 60 votes. Just to do tax cuts for 10 years, you only need 50 votes. But Bob Corker, even before Trump attacked him, came out and he said that he's not going to vote for a tax cut bill if it grows the deficit. And right now, the current plan by Trump and Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell is to grow the national debt by $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years to pay for these tax cuts. And Corker is suggesting that he's not going to go along with that. So if he doesn't go along with that, that means they can only lose really two more votes because Vice President Pence can cast the tie-breaking vote. So you have to hold the rest of the Republican conference together. And we saw during the health care fight that that's easier said than done.
And what about his plans for immigration reform?
Well, so that is another interesting thing where a couple weeks ago, President Trump was obviously telegraphing that he really wanted to work earnestly with Democrats to come up with a fix. And then the hardliners in the White House have sort of won out over Trump. And this past weekend, Sunday night, he released a list of demands in order to do a deal to help these dreamers, these kids who were brought here as minors illegally or as undocumented children. And it includes a lot of poison pills. It basically says he's not going to agree to do anything unless he gets money for his border wall. And he may still blink because he threatened to shut down the government before if he didn't get the money for his border wall, and he ended up going along anyway. The reality, though, is it looks a lot harder than it did 10 days ago to get a big bipartisan deal done on immigration.
James, I find myself wondering whether those Republicans who are in office feel they owe their loyalty to the people of the United States or simply are cowed enough to feel that all they have to do is what President Trump wants.
This is a real test. It's a gut check moment to see whether these lawmakers who have sworn an oath to uphold the Constitution will actually kind of go public with their private concerns.
How many do you think might do that?
I think, you know, certain senators are unconstrained by they don't need to get reelected. You know, someone like John McCain has terminal brain cancer. He just got reelected last year. He's never going to run for reelection again. He doesn't fear Trump or love Trump. And so I think, you know, some of the statesmen in the Senate like him will step up. And I think at a certain point, if there's a critical mass, others will follow. But right now, the president, you know, I call him Fifth Avenue Republicans. These are folks who, you know, the president said he could stand on Fifth Avenue and shoot someone and people would still support him. And polls suggest about 30% of Americans are willing to back the president no matter what he does. And those 30% are Republicans. They vote in Republican primaries and people are afraid of getting crosswise with them. And as long as they're afraid, I think the majority of the Senate Republicans won't change their minds.
What about former presidents? We know that we have all former presidents coming together to raise money to help in Puerto Rico and other areas damaged by flood. Would a statement, a joint statement from those five former presidents carry any sway at all?
I think it would. I think that their moral leadership matters. Even if you're not in a position of authority, I think some people like that coming forward and expressing concern, would they get attacked? Absolutely. Would Trump go after them on Twitter? Absolutely. But would it kind of dislodge some of the maybe people who don't pay close attention to the daily grind of the news to show them that what we're seeing in the White House isn't normal, that presidents of both parties can agree on that, that, you know, the president is really outside the bounds of historic political discourse in this country. And I think that would send a really powerful message. I'm not sure it would totally change the equation, but I think it would be a big moment.
James, I want to go back to something you talked about earlier, and that is if one of the triumvirate around the president resigns, they've agreed all three would resign. Wouldn't that leave the president totally free to do exactly what he wants to do?
Diane, you've discovered the rub of the problem. Yes, absolutely. That would be that's the risk, is that, you know, that Trump kind of has people around him who are sycophants and who kind of bring out his worst impulses, encourage his worst impulses, his most unpresidential thoughts. And then you have the serious adults in the room who, it's not just on national security, but someone like Gary Cohn, who runs the National Economic Council. These people are serious. They care about America's position of leadership in the world. And if they left, it is a real danger that the president will be surrounded by kind of young, inexperienced people who've never been in a crisis before. And so when North Korea provokes us, that all of a sudden the president won't feel encumbered and will do something rash that all of us will regret.
It's my understanding that even on a golf course, the president has with him that person carrying the suitcase, which could trigger World War III. Is that your understanding?
It's not just my understanding. I know for a fact, yes, it is absolutely true. The thing is, we don't really have laws restricting the president's use of a nuclear weapon. By necessity, during the Cold War, if the Soviets had launched thousands of ICBMs at the United States, there was no time to sort of have deliberative process. The president would have to make a quick decision about whether to fire back. And so there's really few constraints. The question in that case is, if the president gave a launch order, would the Secretary of Defense and others in the chain of command obey it, or would they ignore him? You know, and we don't know the answer to that. And that would be a real constitutional crisis. You know, the commander in chief giving an order and people not following it. And I think that there are a lot of people who think a lot about this.
I've been concerned that there have been protests from the North Koreans that U.S. flights have come near to their borders. If one of those flights were to be shot down by the North Koreans, would that be sufficient for the president to launch World War III?
That's what's really scary, is we don't know. And it's sort of everything that we know about Donald Trump and his personality suggests that if an American airplane got shot down, which has happened in the past, that, you know, he wouldn't want to try to defuse that. He would want to escalate it, and he would feel compelled to look tough and strong. And so maybe he bombs North Korea, and then maybe North Korea shells Seoul, which is within the range of its artillery, putting nuclear weapons aside. And so we've seen throughout history, World War I started when Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated, and that set off a cascade of events that led to World War I. We've seen very small things cause big wars. Even in Korea, Dean Acheson gave a speech in the early 1950s saying that, listing what were strategic priorities of the United States that the U.S. was willing to protect, and he omitted Korea. And a lot of experts and historians agree that it was that omission that emboldened the North Koreans in the first place, and that caused us to have to go to war in Korea. So it's small misunderstandings, whether by a poorly spoken choice of words, because of the huge cultural difference between us and them, or some kind of small provocation. Vietnam obviously started with what happened in the Gulf of Tonkin in 1964 and ended up leading to more than 50,000 American kids never coming home. So it's nerve-wracking, because it's hard to imagine in a situation like that the president de-escalating.
James, I know you have no crystal ball. No one does. What are the odds that you see World War III happening?
I'm reluctant to put odds on it. It was Yogi Berra said, I try not to make predictions, especially about the future. And I think it's something people need to be paying more attention to. And this isn't new. Kim Jong-un is a maniacal dictator. And Barack Obama, right before he left office, told President Trump that North Korea was going to be the single biggest foreign policy challenge of his presidency. We've seen North Korea cause massive headaches for George W. Bush, for Bill Clinton. This is a problem that we've had before, and we've managed to avoid war. And so obviously we hope to be able to avoid war here, because, as I said, military guys like Jim Mattis have said, you cannot win a war with North Korea. There's no win. A win is tens of thousands of people dying, and obviously that isn't acceptable.
James, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I must say, it is nerve-wracking to hear you, as someone who's been reporting on these issues for so long and bringing us so much good information, to now hear about how high the threat is. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Good to talk with you. Thanks for having me on, Diane.
Now, a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Author-illustrator Sandra Boynton became known in the late 70s for her endearing drawings of animals on greeting cards. Now, her legions of fans include the youngest readers. Who, along with their appreciative parents.
But if you're not a rabbit, don't worry. It's okay. Just find yourself some bunny ears and you'll be on your way.
Are captivated by the quirky and lovable animal characters featured in her many books. Sandra Boynton has also released several children's music albums, including one just out, Hog Wild. Sandra Boynton, how great to have you with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm afraid my children are a little old now and missed your first book in 1977 because by then they would have been 17 and 14.
Well, I'm sorry I didn't start earlier.
I know, I am too. Because they are just wonderful. Tell me where these ideas came from originally.
Oh, gracious. I wrote my first children's book when I was four, so I wrote and illustrated, so I don't know if I can remember where they came from.
Tell
originally.
Me what that first children's book was like.
It was called, actually, my sister found this when she was in college. I didn't remember it at all. She found it in a bunch of papers. It was called A Funny Animal, and the entire text is, once there was a funny animal, he had a party. All the animals came. They did not like it, so they left. The end. I think I was a very existential four-year-old.
One of your most popular books has got to be, but not The Hippopotamus. A listener, six-year-old Alice, recorded herself reading it.
A hog and a frog cavort in a bog, but not the hippopotamus. A cat and two rats are trying on hats, but not the hippopotamus. A moose and a goose together have juice, but not the hippopotamus.
So tell us about this book.
Well, that book I wrote such a long time ago. I wrote that for my sister who was hippopotamus obsessed, my sister Judy, the same sister who was the reading specialist and found my first children's book. That one started with the sound of the words. And once I knew it was a hippo for my sister Judy, the word hippopotamus is a superb word. And so I just liked the rhythm of, but not the hippopotamus. It's intrinsically musical, that title.
At the end, the hippo joins the other animals, but you end with,
but not the armadillo.
Why not the armadillo?
Some people have described this as a book about exclusion, which it isn't in the least. It's very much about that hippopotamus being reluctant to join in. It's about self-exclusion and then getting the courage to join in. You know, and then some people therefore take it as a sad ending when it's, but not the armadillo, as if once again someone's being excluded. But it really, that's never what it was about.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. How people make their own assumptions about that hippopotamus left on the side. Sandra, I gather you got your start making greeting cards, and you started that in college. How did all that come about?
I was just basically trying to pay my way through college. You know, my parents weren't well off. My dad was a school teacher, and they have four daughters. I was the third of four. So just trying to, you know, help out with my college tuition. And this was the, you know, early 70s, which is effectively still part of the 60s. And my sister, my second sister, Pam, made jewelry and sold it in order to, you know, make some money to help out with her college. And I tried to think of something I could do. And I just started designing gift enclosure cards. And my uncle was a printer. And he printed them, and then I hand-colored them. And within a year's time, I hand-colored 60,000.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, they were not elaborately hand-colored. I hasten to say they were, you know, it was sort of a color wash on each one of them. But so, and then I just went store to store selling those, and it went very well. So that's where I started.
You sure were resourceful, you and your sisters, at a young age.
It's true. I think, you know, my father being a teacher and my mother being an artist, they both were so inspirational for all four of their children. And they just, I don't think we ever had a sense there wasn't anything we couldn't do. And maybe there was an advantage to growing up in a family of four girls, because, of course, all my parents' expectations were on their four daughters. And so there wasn't the sense of, you know, somehow a favored boy or something, which is certainly the story some of my friends have of the families they grew up in. There just wasn't that. There was this sense of infinite possibility. And I also went to a Quaker school, which is where my dad taught from kindergarten through 12th grade. And, you know, Quaker education is remarkably supportive of individual artistic expression and, you know, it's a combined virtue of community and of individuality.
Then when you began producing cards and trying to sell them, what happened?
It went unusually easily for me, which is pretty surprising. If you looked at my early cards, they really weren't very good, but they were charming. They were awkward and charming, I guess. You know, I sold them while I was still in college. You know, I was the second class of women at Yale. And when I graduated, I realized I was on my way to graduate school, and I thought, I cannot keep up doing the cards and the kind of graduate work I'll be doing. So I met a company at a trade show, Recycled Paper Greetings, and that they took over the production and sale of the designs, and I got paid a royalty for them. So it was sort of the best of both worlds. I knew enough about commerce and retail and how my cards did, but from selling them myself, and I also had the luxury of then stopping doing that and turning all that over to a, you know, people who like doing things like selling and warehousing, which I did not. So it was perfect.
I just wonder, when you have adult interpretations of the books as they read to the children, whether there are different insights you get from adult reactions to those books.
I guess I don't really hear, you know, I'm not there sort of being part of that interface between, you know, parents and their children or adults and their children. You know, certainly a lot of my books I wrote when my own children, you know, I have four children, were little. To me, there really shouldn't be this dividing line between work for adults and work for what works for children, what works for adults. I mean, obviously, there's certainly adult things that are inappropriate for children, but there shouldn't be children's things that don't resonate with adults. I don't think that makes sense, which is why I do children's music in quite a different way than children's music is often done. From my point of view, it shouldn't be oversimplified. You shouldn't be able to tell it's children's music if you're hearing it in the next room. It should just sound like music, and that's why I've spent so much time, joyful time, you know, in a whole different direction for me.
In his latest book, Hog Wild, the first story is titled Dance It Out, and it really does resonate with me as an adult when I read the words, I don't want to make it complicated, I'm not going to let it take me down. If the world is getting me frustrated, let me, oh, let me hear that sound so I can dance it out, dance it out.
I don't want to make it complicated. I'm not going to let it take me down. If the world is getting me frustrated, let me, oh, let me hear that sound so I can dance it out.
I mean, that speaks to my heart as an adult.
Well, I'm delighted that it does, because from my point of view, it's human experience I'm trying to write to. I'm not trying to compartmentalize a child's experience. And so I'm delighted that that works for you. And then, you know, I got to record that song. The person who sang it is Kristen Bell, who, you know, wonderful actress, wonderful singer, and much revered both by adults and by children for her superb work and for her wonderful singing and for her heart. So the delight of her being able to then present the song, and, you know, and my delight in working with her, she was phenomenal. So it's all, I just feel very lucky to be able to do this kind of work and with people that I admire and that it resonates with children and adults.
Particular people in mind when you write your songs. In Tyrannosaurus Funk, Samuel L. Jackson seems ideal.
That's no, absolutely. The song that you mentioned, the Tyrannosaurus Funk, you know, when I was writing it, I heard Samuel L. Jackson in my head. You know, he seemed the perfect person to help me imagine doing the song as I was writing it.
T-Rex, T-Rex,
take it up.
T-Rex, T-Rex.
I never thought I would actually get him. I found that I have a friend who's an agent in Hollywood, and a longtime friend. And when I sent him the song, and I said, "Here's Tyrannosaurus Funk, and I'm hearing Samuel L. Jackson. Who do you recommend for it?" He said, "Well, why not Sam?" And I said, "Because I don't know Sam." And he said, "Well, I know somebody who knows him well." So I didn't expect that to happen. And so I sent it off to Samuel Jackson's manager. And literally 2 days later, she said, "I love the song. Sam loves the song. Can you be here in Hollywood a day after tomorrow?"
And wow.
I live on the East Coast. So I said, "Oh, absolutely." And so I had to scramble together to get the studio time and to get the engineer and to get everything in place. But it was exhilarating to fly across the country and suddenly find yourself in the studio.
I'm bigger than life.
No special effects.
I can call you whatever. You can call me Max T-Rex.
And what a nice man. What a nice man.
Oh, I'm so glad. And he not only sings it, he talks part of it.
Tiny dino in a Panama hat. Purple shades. What's up with that? Uptown lizard. Quick and fancy. Go look at me. Whoa, I'm so fancy.
Yeah, it's... But I think that's part of why I thought of him when I was writing it. It seemed, you know, the particular character of this Tyrannosaurus is very cool and very confident. And it seemed to me it needed a kind of rhythmic push that really emphasized, you know, the speaking rhythm of it. So, you know, and he does both well. He sings well, and he obviously speaks well as a superb actor. So that's really how that came about.
I'm just loving the illustrations, Sandra. I'm looking at the title piece, Hog Wild, which begins away out here in the countryside. We all like it nice and quiet. We all take it pretty slow. But every now and then we really go. And then all the barnyard animals seem to go absolutely musically nuts, playing and dancing. You had great fun with that.
I had great fun with that. That was a particularly complex drawing. As you can see, it covers two pages, and there are a lot of dancing animals on it and a lot of instrumentalists. So it was a complicated but really fun drawing to do. And then you know, that track was sung by the amazing Patrick Wilson, who I first saw, oh my goodness, 15 years ago in Oklahoma on Broadway. I mean, you've heard the track. He nails it.
Absolutely.
Away out here in the countryside, we all like it nice and quiet. We all take it pretty slow, but every now and then we really go hog wild. We're going to move our feet hog wild.
We're gonna rock that beat, every man, woman, chicken, and child. Come on over now, cause we're going hog wild. Come on over now, cause we're going hog wild.
You know, we asked for some questions on Facebook, and we got so many responses from people who were so excited you were going to be on the podcast. And
oh, that's great.
Yeah, and a question came from Amy, and she said her six-year-old asks, why aren't there people?
Well, there are occasional people, but there are a number of reasons. One is I don't draw people very well. But there's actually a really good reason, too, which is when you do animals, it frees you up from having to make decisions about age and race and gender and all kinds of things that could be loaded and narrowing of the sort of broad spectrum human experience of them. So, oddly enough, using animals makes it more likely to access a broader range of human experience rather than seem to be making some other, you know, have some other point that you're making. You know, for example, you can delight in the sheer bulk of a hippo, but if you draw, you know, a heavy person, then you're going, am I, you know, seeming to make a commentary? Is there something, you know, I mean, there's something, there's just too much weight on the, there's too much baggage on that. So, you know, my animals are not really very, very animal-like in a way. There's some, they're pretty anthropomorphic. So, I don't know. Sorry, that's way too long an answer for.
No, I love it. I love it. I love the cows. I love the pigs with their little snouts. I love the rabbits, the little puppies. Tell us a little about your surroundings, where you live, how you spend your days.
Well, I live in the foothills of the Berkshire Mountains in New England, and I live on a farm. You know, with a working farm across the street, mine is not a working farm. It's a historical farm, but it's not a working farm. My husband and I have four children. Three of them live close by, and one of them lives in New York City, which isn't too far away, 2.5 hours. I don't know. I love to do what I do, so I spend a lot of time, you know, my studio is a barn, and I spend a lot of time in my barn drawing and making stuff. It's just what I love to do.
It's wonderful. Tell me about your husband. I know he died not long ago.
He was just the best person in the world. He just the best person in the world. He was kind and funny and smart and fearless and thoughtful. Everything you can imagine. Superb husband, superb father. He was a whitewater racer and a writer. So he was in two Olympics. He was in the 1972 Olympics and the 1992 Olympics. And he didn't want to live long enough to see our son in the Olympics last year in Rio in the same sport. And I don't know what else to, you know, we met in a drama class at Yale and we were very happy. And as you know, people leave. You know, he died, and that's, I don't know what to say about it. Just, it's impossible.
Have you written a book about that kind of loss?
I think it's inexpressible in certain ways. No, I don't think that's my strong point to, you know, I'm writing about optimism and joy in what I do already, and that's what's important to try to access. I don't think I have anything to say other than it's hard, and you know, loss doesn't go away. And how can it? You know, It's strange to me that people, you know, 3 years later sort of feel, oh, you should be moving on, because of course, if a person were not dead and they were just away that long, people would say, oh, this must be so hard. It's been so long. So anyway, that's, I can't, as you can hear, I can't be articulate about it.
When you were growing up, your parents read to you, I'm sure, and I'm wondering whether you had favorite books as a child yourself.
Oh, yeah, my parents read all the time. I loved Maurice Sendak's work.
My favorite.
I mean, that's why I started to read. I loved the book Little Bear so much. I think I was 4, and I was determined to actually read it. And it's the book that taught me to read. And he was a teacher of mine in college, so that was amazing to come full circle and then find, and a wonderful teacher. I loved Eloise. I think it's a remarkable book, a remarkable synergy between illustrator and writer. I love Crockett Johnson, Harold and Purple Crayon, all those things. Boy, there's so many. I could go on and on and on. And then from my own children's childhood, too, you know, William Steig or Jules Feiffer, just on and on. And there's so much wonderful work.
On your Twitter feed, a number of posts reference that you and your work have been a comfort after the Las Vegas shooting. So I wonder if that surprises you.
It doesn't actually surprise me. That's what I'm trying to do in my work. It's what I've always tried to do in my work. First and foremost, for me, any artist is first writing for him or herself, or drawing, or playing music, or whatever. You're your own first audience, and a key one. If you're writing with some idea of what other people might respond to, but you're not thinking vigilantly and constantly about what you respond to, then what you write or do is going to have a false note to it. So I find what I do comforting and reassuring. So it delights me that other people find it the way it did, but it doesn't surprise me.
Well, Sandra Boynton, I think you, with your books and your music, have just given us all so much pleasure. And if I had younger grandchildren, I'd be reading to them and singing with them right now. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
The sun has set not long ago. Now everybody goes below to take a bath in one big tub with soap all over. Scrub, scrub, scrub. They hang their towels onto the wall and find pajamas big and small. With some on top and some beneath, they brush and brush and brush. And when the moon is on the rise, they all go up to exercise. And down once more, but not so fast. They're on their way to bed at last. The day is done. They say good night. And somebody turns off the light. The moon is high and the sea is deep. They rock and rock and rock to sleep. Good night, baby.
And that's it for this week. I have to tell you, I have a pretty big weekend coming up. On Saturday here in Washington, I'm getting married to John Hagedorn. I promise to put pictures up on the website. We'll take a one-week honeymoon. My great friend and colleague Tom Jelton of NPR will host the podcast next week. We'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. That number, 202-854-8851. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker, Rebecca Kaufman, and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.